My name is Joshua Barton. I am the philosophy librarian here at the MSU Libraries, and I'd like to welcome you all to today's installment of the Michigan Writer Series. This series of talks by Michigan writers recognizes the important work done by authors here in our state. More recently, there's been an emphasis on important work done here on our campus. In the case that this series features work by MSU faculty, as it does today, the featured works are held in the MSU Libraries Faculty Book Collection on the first floor of the library's West Wing. Today's speaker, Dr. Leonard Fleck, received his PhD from St. Louis University and his bachelor's from Loyola University, Chicago. He's currently professor of philosophy and medical ethics in the Department of Philosophy and in the Center for Ethics and Humanities in the Life Sciences at Michigan State University. Prior to Michigan State, Dr. Fleck taught at Indiana University South Bend and at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. Dr. Fleck's main areas of teaching and research are medical ethics, healthcare policy, and social and political philosophy. He has facilitated dialogue about healthcare policy on the state and national level through various community education projects as a member of the White House Task Force on Healthcare Reform in 1993. And through involvement with the NIH Genome Project from 1995 to 2002. He has published widely on his areas of interest, most recently in his book, which he will be speaking on this afternoon, Just Caring, Healthcare Rationing and Democratic Deliberation, published this year by Oxford University Press. Dr. Fleck was elected as a fellow of the Hastings Center in 2002 and honored with a University Distinguished Faculty Award by Michigan State University in 2003. And Dr. Fleck has been nice enough to bring books with him this afternoon that he'll be happy to sign. He signed them for $30, which is at a significant discount off the list price. And he says if he runs out of copies, he'll take your name and address to get you one. So with that, please join me in welcoming Dr. Fleck.
Good afternoon, everyone. Let me give you a picture of where I think we're, or how things are going to go this afternoon. I'm going to talk for maybe 30 minutes, 35 minutes, something like that. I want to give you an overall picture of the issues that I address in the book, how I address them, what sort of the take-home message is. And then we should have ample time for your questions. I do want to give you plenty of time to ask questions and follow up on points I may make over the course of this lecture. We can start, I think, by looking at, let's see, there's the ad. Everybody has a sponsor. We can start with the title of the book, Just Caring. The book addresses what I call the just caring problem, and the just caring problem can be captured in this statement. What does it mean, or this question, what does it mean to be a just and caring society when we have only limited resources, dollars, to meet virtually unlimited healthcare needs? Why in the world would healthcare needs be unlimited? Because over the past 40 years, we have seen these huge advances with new medical technologies in virtually every area of medicine. And the consequence of that is that what we call needs, in that sort of morally special use of the word needs, has expanded dramatically over the past 40 years. And I'm going to give you lots and lots of examples of what that means in practice. The implication of the just caring problem is that when limited resources, unlimited needs, we can't meet all needs. So that means some needs are going to go unmet. That means, in reality, that we have to make rationing decisions. That is, we have to figure out, and I'm using the we here to refer to all of us as citizens of this society, we have to figure out what kinds of healthcare needs should be a very high priority and should be guaranteed in terms of access for all in our society, and which kinds of healthcare needs or which kinds of healthcare interventions should be given relatively low priority, because they yield too little good at too great a cost relative to all the other needs that exist in our society. The basic argument I make when I say that the need for healthcare rationing is inescapable is that even though the word rationing has all kinds of negative connotations associated with it, and of course if you've been following the health reform debates, you're very well aware of that fact, Nevertheless, there is nothing intrinsically morally objectionable about the concept of rationing. What makes rationing morally objectionable is when it's the case that the healthy, wealthy, and politically powerful impose rationing decisions on the sick, the weak, the poor, and the vulnerable. The alternative to rationing in that sense is to say that all of us, as members of a democratic society, would engage in a public conversation, democratic deliberation, in the subtitle of the book, to figure out what we collectively would judge to be the kinds of healthcare services under particular clinical circumstances that we would be willing to give up for our own future possible selves. In other words, rationing decisions would be self-imposed and would be imposed freely. And that's what would give moral legitimacy to those kinds of decisions, a legitimacy that, as things are now in the United States, the rationing that, in fact, is done in arbitrary and non-rational kinds of way doesn't have. One of the take-home messages from my presentation this afternoon is captured on this slide over here. This is going to hurt. That is, the advocates for health reform like to suggest that health reform can be accomplished with minimal pain. And I think that is not as honest as it ought to be, though I understand politics and so on. Health reform will be painful and must be painful for each one of us. Otherwise, we're not going to achieve reform. The problems of our healthcare system are substantial. They are not trivial or minimal, as I'm going to try to suggest here in this presentation. So first, some political cartoons, because everybody likes cartoons. What are the challenges that we face? Well, you got this guy in the boat here who represents all of us, who says, whoa, this business of health reform looks risky. And he's not paying attention to the fact that they're going over the rapids, over the falls, and they're in an already very, very dangerous kind of situation. We have to do some radical kinds of things to address the problems that our healthcare system faces. Another political cartoon with my own heading here, no health reform conservatives in the ICU. The heading underneath says, a liberal is a conservative who got mugged by his health insurance company, which is, I think, an accurate assessment of things. And here we have another interesting cartoon. Your tumor is still growing. I've been assured the market will cure it. No, my argument is that the reliance upon market economics is not going to bring about a resolution to the problem of healthcare cost control. If anything, the capitalism itself, the mechanisms of capitalism in our society have exacerbated that problem. That's not an intrinsic flaw. That's not to say that capitalism is intrinsically flawed and anything like that. So I'm not making any kind of ideological statement there. I'm simply saying that hard-eyed objective economists will say that capitalistic economics create really serious problems within a healthcare system, and we'll see why. Can we do health reform on the cheap? Nope. Lots of people think that maybe there's just a little tinkering here, a little tinkering there on the edges, and we're going to call that health reform. It's not going to work. We need some very serious changes within our healthcare system. This cartoon doesn't have any words because it doesn't need any words. Everybody understands what that one's about. And there you see President Obama with the alligators all over the place. And he's saying, these gentlemen have volunteered to help drain the healthcare swamp. And that's the insurance industry and the big pharma and HMOs and hospitals and so on. And so all of you are familiar with the old adage, you know, keep your friends closer, keep your enemies closer. But at least my argument would be that that's a prescription for disaster so far as health reform goes. You don't want those crocodiles anywhere near you if you want to be successful in achieving health reform. So My key claims are the following. The just caring problem is, if we're going to have significant health reform, the just caring problem itself has to be explicitly acknowledged as a problem that all of us have to collectively address. That is, what we want to achieve, the two primary goals of health reform are, first of all, to make sure everybody is covered with a comprehensive health care plan. So the 47 million uninsured in our society and the 20 or 30 million additional individuals who are underinsured. That would be the first objective of health reform. But in order to accomplish that and have a health care system overall that's affordable, given limited resources, we're going to have to do something to control health care costs. That's the rationing problem. That's the just caring problem. And that problem has to be addressed through a broad public conversation. Does our health care system need reform? And we can say, yeah, no system's perfect. But our health care system is unjust in a number of basic respects, and so that's one reason why it needs reform. Our health care system often prevents physicians from providing needed care to their patients, and this is very frustrating for physicians. I mean, one of the issues for physicians is you've got 10 patients in your waiting room, all of whom have exactly the same medical problem, because that's what philosophers do. We set up examples that way. And they all have different health insurance and with different kinds of limitations, restrictions, copayments, deductibles, and so on. And the consequence will be that even though the physician is hopes to provide excellent medical care to each one of those patients, he or she will find his or her hands effectively prevented from providing the care that each of those patients really needs. Physicians are generous in giving of their time and energy for free to patients who are impoverished in various ways, but what physicians can't do is they can't provide patients with a free MRI scan. They don't own it. They can't provide patients with free surgery or free hospital days. They don't own those resources. Somebody else owns them. What are some possible healthcare injustices in our system? We often fail to meet the fundamental healthcare needs of individuals who don't have the ability to pay. And when we think about what healthcare is and what it represents in our society in terms of protecting fair equality of opportunity, protecting basic life, and so on, that would strike me as being something that's fundamentally unjust. We oftentimes expend very large volumes of healthcare dollars for only very slight healthcare gains when there are lots of other unmet healthcare needs that where we could achieve lots of good at a much lower cost. Just to make clear what the problem is there, the problem is that for Americans who have very good health insurance, as we do here at Michigan State University, when it comes to demanding what we think is best for our own personal medical interests, we will demand the best because our insurance will pay for it. And demanding the best will oftentimes mean demanding cutting-edge medical interventions that nevertheless, even though they're cutting-edge and that has a certain kind of meaning attached to it, nevertheless will yield only very small benefits at a very large cost. The more individuals who are well-insured who make those demands on the healthcare system, the more that increases the price of health insurance. The more cost of health insurance goes up, the more often employers who are kind of at the margins end up just saying, we're not going to do health insurance for our employees anymore. And so you then push up the number who are uninsured who then don't have the ability to get any kind of health care, no matter how effective it is, unless it's extraordinarily cheap for them. We assert as a political value the equal value of all lives, but the lives that really matter as a practical matter are the lives of patients, spelled correctly from my point of view on that slide. We allow opportunities to maximize profits to corrupt and take precedence over the core values of medicine. What's the example I have in mind there? The fact of the matter is that, and this is where the core functioning of capitalism comes in, many physicians in other parts of the country, not in Michigan, but in more so the south and western parts of our country, have opened up for-profit hospitals, small hospitals, specialty hospitals that do only cardiology or that do only cancer, do only orthopod, 30-bed hospitals in which small group of physicians are investor owners of those hospitals. They don't have an emergency room. They don't take any indigent patients or non-paying patients or Medicaid patients. They only take patients who have excellent health insurance. This is how capitalism functions. One of the consequences of that, then, is that in some communities, you've got community hospitals, the equivalent of Sparrow or Ingham here, who are then, they lose those patients who are most capable of paying for the health care that they need, and as a consequence, they're stuck with a disproportionate share of patients who don't have the ability to pay for the care they need, and so their ability to provide high-quality care then gets compromised as a result of those kinds of choices. Okay. We're not going to go through everything on all these slides because I want to get through them all. We oftentimes fail to inform patients of varying incentives for controlling health care costs that may shape medical judgment in one way or another. This is what the managed care movement was all about in the 1990s. One of the things that you may or may not be aware of is that the total amount of money spent in our healthcare system last year was $2.5 trillion, about 17% of our gross domestic product. And if I ask you, who spent all that money? The short answer is 80% of those dollars were spent by physicians. Physicians are the ones who have what you might call the professional authority to authorize those expenditures. So they're the ones who say, I've made this diagnosis, you need this very expensive drug, you need the surgical intervention, you need to be in the hospital for a certain period of time, you need this or you need that. And in that sense, physicians are making allocation decisions. And so when we're struggling to figure out how do we control healthcare costs, the answer that a number of healthcare analysts gave in the early 1990s was you have to find ways of incentivizing physicians to make more cost-effective decisions, that is, to make rationing decisions with regard to their patients. And you do that by saying either we'll pay you bonuses or give you 50% of whatever you save by denying patients very expensive care that we don't really want to pay for and so on, or we're going to threaten your income. Your salary is going to be $200,000 a year, but we're going to withhold 30% of it. And if you fail to meet your cost control targets in a given quarter, then in effect you're going to lose a portion of what you thought was your salary. That becomes a powerful incentive. Patients in general weren't aware of how those particular incentives worked. Here's some cases that are intended to sort of focus our attention more concretely. Dr. Michael DeBakey, some of you may recognize his name. This was an extraordinarily prominent cardiologist who made a number of important advances in medicine and so on. At age 97, he was struggling with a dissecting aortic aneurysm, which he diagnosed in himself because he knew all about this. He had written a textbook on it. He wasn't sure that he really wanted surgery that was necessary to save his life. He feared what the outcome of surgery might be, that there would be plaque material that would be loosened in the course of doing the surgery, go to his brain, and cause him to be significantly cognitively impaired. But nevertheless, his friends and family persuaded him to undergo the surgery, so he did. Surgery was done well, I'm sure, but nevertheless, there were, given his age and all, there are lots of complications associated with the surgery. So he ended up being in the hospital for a total of 8 months at a cost of more than $1 million. But he was glad to be alive a year later in January of 07. He died within a year of that. The question that I would have to ask you is, would it have been unjust if we, as a society, had some kind of rationing protocol that would have denied him that care? If we had agreed ahead of time as a society that care like that was yielded too little benefit in terms of life extension at a likely too high a cost and so on. And so he would not be seen as a candidate for that kind of surgery under those circumstances. And the idea is that by, in effect, denying him, if we were to agree to that as a rationing protocol, the dollars that would be saved would be reallocated to meet what the elderly themselves might judge to be higher priority health care needs, where they could derive more good from those particular expenditures. Here's Mr. Diaz, 69 years old. This was a case that actually came from a story in the Wall Street Journal. He has advanced Alzheimer's. The first signs of Alzheimer's were in the early 1990s. He was cared for by his brother. He had choked on food in 2002, and which caused brain damage, and he ended up as a bent-dependent individual in a hospital on a feeding tube. He then developed pneumonia and intestinal bleeding, and nobody could figure out what the source of the bleeding was or get to it or do anything about it. So he ended up spending 140 days in the hospital at a cost of $280,000. The question that I ask, that I think we ought to ask ourselves, is would it have been unjust if we were to deny him that care? And if we were to deny him that care because he was in the end stages of Alzheimer's, and there was nothing we could do to give him a reasonable, acceptable, or meaningful quality of life anymore. There's an article in, I believe it's the health section of this week's New York Times, that speaks precisely to this issue and calls attention to how aggressive we continue to be in caring for end-stage Alzheimer's patients in the way of providing them with dialysis and all kinds of other fairly aggressive and expensive medical interventions that do sustain their bodies but do nothing to give them back any kind of reasonable quality of life. Here's Michael S., an infant born with necrotic small bowel syndrome. Infants born very prematurely are vulnerable to this particular problem. There are about 4,000 infants like this born each year in the United States. He was born to uninsured teenage parents, which is, again, the common scenario. And because he didn't have a functioning gut, he needed TPN, total parenteral nutrition, in order to survive, the cost of which is about $200,000 per year. The problem is that this intervention that's saving his life is also destroying his liver. And so that he will survive for approximately 4 years until he goes into liver failure. And then the option is, if you want to save his life for another couple more years, you can do a liver transplant for $250,000. And then he still needs the TPN, so that's going to destroy that liver too. And then the option, in theory, in practice, this is not, can't work very often. You have a total bowel transplant, which would, again, save him from death for about 3 years, maybe a little bit longer, if in fact that's a viable option. Would it be unjust if we had a rationing protocol as a society that said, we're going to have to allow Michael to die, that this is not a reasonable use of resources? 4,000 infants times per year times the cost of saving them in the NICU and then providing TPN and so on, this represents $2 to $3 billion per cohort. And over, when you got four cohorts going all at once, then you're looking at about $8 billion per year. Now, this, all of this may—I don't know how you react to this initially. It may sound very harsh to talk about denying individuals life-sustaining care. But then, this is what you have to look at, and this is the other side of the coin. Here's Ginny. Again, this is a story that came from the Wall Street Journal. Age 5, she had been a blue baby at birth, so she had a defective heart. Surgery sort of addressed that problem, but now at age 16, she has an arrhythmic problem with her heart, but it's well controlled by an expensive medication. She is, her family is poor. This is in West Virginia. They're on Medicaid. At age 19, she seeks employment to cover her health care bills because she's no longer eligible for Medicaid to pay for that expensive medication. But no employer is going to hire her because of her congenital heart disease, which would, and all the employers in West Virginia that were accessible to her were small employers, and so they would have to take on a huge economic burden, which would make health insurance unaffordable for everyone in that company. So nobody would hire her. She was found dead at age 19. She hadn't taken her meds for 5 months due to expiration of her Medicaid eligibility. From a moral point of view, how should we assess her death? There are young people who die tragically of various kinds of medical problems, and those deaths, by and large, are seen as being unfortunate outcomes. Is it morally sufficient to describe her death as being merely unfortunate? Or should we see that as something that is unjust? Now, part of what I'm sort of suggesting by this little run of cases is that if we want to save Ginny-like patients, and there are 45,000 patients each year in the United States who die prematurely, whose primary cause of death, if we were to just look at it really objectively, is lack of health insurance. They end up being denied. That happens because they're denied the health care that they need when they have a medical problem that is at an early treatable stage. We're forced to treat them in an emergency room when a potentially fatal disease process has reached a critical point and is life-threatening, and then it's too late. They will die. And somebody like Ginny would be one of those 45,000 individuals. And so if we want to save those 45,000 individuals, and the only way you can do that is by insuring everybody who's currently uninsured, then we're going to have to make some hard choices regarding those first three cases that I put up there. Why do we see this as a problem of healthcare justice? The short answers are because healthcare in our society is effective. It makes the difference between life and death. It protects a fair equality of opportunity, and that's a value that presumably we all agree upon as Americans. It is the case that what we think of as this very sophisticated healthcare system we have today is in fact a product of an investment, taxes and donations and so on, by all Americans, whether insured or not, in building hospitals and providing research money through NIH and underwriting the cost of medical education, training physicians, and so on. And so that, I'm arguing, gives all of us a presumptive claim to the fruits of these public investments that all of us have made. 2008, we spent, again, to give you now a sense of the dimensions of the problem, we spent $2.5 trillion on health care, about 17% of our gross domestic product. Back in 1960, total health spending was only $26 billion, a little over 5%. The projections, the best projections to 2018, conservative projections, are that we'll be at $4.5 trillion, or about 20% of what we hope is our gross domestic product at that time. Compared to other countries, in Europe, for example, they'll spend generally 8 to 10% currently of gross domestic product on health care. Switzerland is in second place in the world, spending 11% of their gross domestic product on health care. Some other things you need to know to appreciate sort of the shape and complexity of this problem that I'm addressing, the just caring problem. In 2008, roughly 35% of our total health care expenditures, so that's going to be about $820 billion, that was consumed by the 13% of our population that was over age 65. So when we look at where healthcare dollars go, they are disproportionately go to the upper end of the age spectrum. And even within the upper end of the age spectrum, what you find is that there is very much a skewing. It's not as if all people who are older have serious health problems. On the contrary, most older people in our society are in relatively good health. But there is a segment of that population that has serious, costly, chronic conditions that are a source of that problem. In 2025, when the post-World War II baby boom generation, which I'm at the leading edge of, has mostly aged out, there are going to be 76 million of us who are over age 65. We will then make up about 21% of the population, and we're going to create even more of a problem in terms of a distortion of healthcare spending than we have now. And that assumes that we would only demand what the current generation of the elderly demand in the way of access to healthcare through the Medicare program. But the fact of the matter is we'll continue to see medical progress, and the likelihood is that we will demand a richer and more expensive package of health benefits than the current generation of the elderly. And those costs are going to be pushed off to the generations behind us who will have to pay the taxes to support the system. This graph shows you going out from 1970 to the year 2050, the projected tax revenues in the U.S., that's the red line there, and you can see what the shortfall is as a percentage of gross domestic product. in that middling area. We see Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, that takes the bulk, more than half of total federal expenditures by the time we get out to 2050. These are really pretty reliable projections. This gives you a sense of what how the cost of saving each year of life increases dramatically by age. There are about, I said, 47 million individuals without health insurance. If we do nothing, if there's no health reform this year, that number will be in the 55 to 60 million range by 2012, and it will continue to go up from there. I have, on these next few slides, I'm going to ask you to read them quickly so that I can just move along more quickly. But I want you to think about different aspects of the problem of healthcare justice and what we might think of as being the injustices that are intrinsic to our healthcare system. One I'll call your particular attention to is the first one here. Is it unjust that I, for example, who is a very secure member of the middle class, should get a 45% tax subsidy from the federal government for my health insurance, while individuals who work for Walmart or at relatively low-wage jobs and who have to buy health insurance out of their own after-tax dollars get no subsidy at all? But that's what happens in the U.S. So the average value of a health care plan for a family of four in the U.S. today is $13,000. And theoretically, and the university pays that on my behalf. If that were added to my income, then that 28% of that $13,000 would be federal taxes, and then there'd be 15% in Social Security taxes, and then 4% or so of state income taxes that would have to be paid. But in fact, it's all tax-free. And so that's the subsidy that individuals who are securely in the middle class get in connection with their health care benefits. It doesn't seem just that those who are already financially well off should be getting this kind of subsidy, welfare, from the federal government, while those who are substantially less well off would be denied any kind of comparable advantage. National health insurance is not going to solve the just caring problem. We have to be realistic about that. I would be in favor of a Canadian-style single-payer system, but I'm objective enough to realize that that will not alter. That will not solve the just caring problem by itself. We have to make other kind of choices to accomplish that. Why do healthcare costs increase inexorably? And here's a list. The insurance mechanism itself propels upward healthcare costs for one reason I gave earlier. If I'm very well insured and I have a really good opinion of myself, I in effect say to myself, I'm worth $1 million worth of health care. I don't know about any of the rest of you, but I'm sure that I am. And so I'm not going to deny myself anything if, in fact, my insurance, it's somebody else. It's you guys who are really paying for it. Thank you. And so that the insurance mechanism itself has an inflationary quality to it. But the biggest source of increasing health care costs are those new medical technologies. And the sort of examples I'll give to illustrate this point are that the point I made earlier was that new medical technologies mean new medical needs. So if I were to ask you how many people in 1970 in the U.S. needed coronary bypass surgery, the correct answer is nobody, because bypass surgery had barely been invented then. But last year we did about 500,000 bypasses at a cost of approximately $70,000 each, so that's about $45 billion for that intervention. And in addition to that, we did 1.2 million coronary angioplasties. That's that sort of balloon procedure in the coronary artery, and then you put a stent in there to push back the plaque and all. That costs $40,000 each, so that's another $45 or $50 billion. In addition to that, so you appreciate what the problem is here, we have in clinical testing right now something called the totally implantable artificial heart. A device the size of my fist implanted in the chest cavity after you remove the natural heart. That device, with the surgery and all, will cost about $300,000 per procedure. Computer modeling says there are about 350,000 individuals each year in the U.S. who could potentially benefit with, on average, 5 extra years of life if we were to make that widely available. The cost of doing that would be $105 billion more per year in additional health care costs. Now, one of the things to note in terms of understanding what the problem is here, it's not the case that one of these technologies replaces this other. They're all additive. Okay? I gave you examples of very costly technologies at the individual level. But the other examples I could have given you, many of you are probably familiar with a class of drugs called statins, which are cholesterol-lowering drugs. Those drugs cost about $1,200 for a year's supply of the drug. Okay, there are currently about 15 or 16 million Americans who are on those drugs. There was a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine that said that if we really want to be serious about helping Americans to lower their cholesterol without having to bother with diet and exercise and all that other kind of sweaty stuff, then about 65 million Americans ought to be on these drugs. Whoa! 65 million times $1,200 gives you a number around $70 billion for just one type of drug that's used in connection with heart disease. This doesn't say anything about ACE inhibitors or beta blockers or any of the other kinds of drugs that are used to manage different aspects of heart disease. I haven't gone out to talk about any other. I haven't talked about cancer or COPD or liver disease or renal failure. And so there's all that stuff out there as well. Competition among healthcare providers. Ah, that's where capitalism is supposed to save us. The more competition you have, you drive down costs, you save money. That's how capitalism works. That's how capitalism works very well outside of healthcare. Inside healthcare, it ain't the way it works. And so one of the news articles that I saw a couple months ago is that a hospital, I can name it, it was in the newspaper, McLaren, said that they were going to invest in a machine called a proton beam accelerator. This is housed in a building with walls that are 12 feet thick, a building the size of a football field that costs $140 to $150 million to build. And these proton beam accelerators are aimed at destroying cancerous cells in areas that are not easily reached by a surgery or that are only reached by radiation beams that are a little too diffuse and may damage other things and so on. 4 other hospitals in Michigan, within a week of seeing that announcement, said, we're going to build one too. And you can imagine, this is just in Michigan, that this results in extraordinarily high costs per use of the machine because there aren't enough patients who can possibly use those machines efficiently. But those other hospitals are not going to send their patients to McLaren and give them their business. They're not. That's how competition works in healthcare. An increase in the burden of chronic illness. One of the phrases that one writer used as the title of his book was doing better and feeling worse. That's where we are in our healthcare system. So if I ask you, I gave you all those heart examples. If I ask you, how many people should have died in the United States this year of heart disease if we had the same pattern of mortality as we had in 1970, the correct answer would be about 1.5 million. How many people actually died? About 750,000. We're doing better. We saved 750,000 people last year who otherwise would have died of their heart disease. That's what's great about the American healthcare system. Hooray for us. So how are we feeling worse? Well, the thing is, even if you got an artificial heart inside of you or whatever, you're not immortal. And so you're still going to be faced with, especially as you get older, with cancer. You're at risk for stroke. You're at risk for Alzheimer's. We now have about 4.5 million Alzheimer's patients in the U.S. The projections are, with post-World War II baby boom generation, that number by 2030 or so will be at approximately 16 million. Alzheimer's patients in the end stages are in nursing homes at a current cost of $60,000 to $70,000 per year. It's about $100 billion that's spent on Alzheimer's patients right now. And the other thing you'll notice is, and so there's an increase in the burden of chronic illnesses. The more we save patients, which is a good thing to do, don't anybody mishear me in that respect, we have to understand that one of the consequences is that there are more and more kinds of things. And so when you look at the literally millions of knee replacements, hip replacements, and other things we do for patients who are in their 80s and 90s, they're in their 80s and 90s because we saved them from what otherwise might have been a fatal outcome earlier on in their lives. This is just a quick list, you can look at it, of some of the kinds of things that are currently adding to the advancing healthcare costs. Chronic conditions are concentrated among the elderly. The last point on the bottom there, 23% of Medicare beneficiaries with five or more chronic conditions consume 68% of Medicare dollars. That's the skewing effect that I was talking about earlier. I'm going to call it one of the more challenging, morally challenging problem is what we call last chance therapies, because these are very expensive at the individual level and in the aggregate. We say, but this is somebody's last chance for survival. How could we possibly deny them that? We operate with something called a rule of rescue in our society. And the rule of rescue, that we invoke that when there's somebody who's decided they're going to take a sailboat across the Atlantic because this is a fun thing to do, and they're in huge trouble. And we hear about it on the radio or something, so we send out all these ships and planes to rescue them, and it costs millions of dollars. And we say, we got to do that because we are a kind and compassionate society, even for stupid people who try to sail across the Atlantic in a 12-foot sailboat. But the rule of rescue in healthcare means then that we're rescuing somebody not just once, but repeatedly because of what all these advanced medical technologies make possible. And then last couple points. Cancer drugs are one of the other huge areas where this is a problem. And so you see the generic or the technical scientific name of some of these drugs. This was in an article in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, How Much Is Life Worth? Cetuximab and these other drugs in non-small cell lung cancer, the $440 billion question. But what this slide says is for Erbitux used in this connection, the cost of achieving 1.2 extra months of life with that cancer drug is $80,000. Okay? And as the authors of that article write, if we allow a survival advantage of 1.2 months to be worth $80,000 and by extrapolation survival of a year to be valued at $800,000, we would need $440 billion annually to extend by 1 year the life of the 550,000 Americans who die of cancer annually, and no one would be cured. How do we want to deal with that problem? So, I don't think I want to go through any more slides here. The need for healthcare rationing is inescapable. That's one of the take-home messages. And so what I'm suggesting here is that what we have to do is, in thinking through this problem, we have to ask ourselves, what kind of healthcare for our future possible selves is worth it? And what kind of healthcare are we willing not to deny people we don't care about at all who are strangers to us, but what kind of healthcare are we willing to deny our future possible selves because we believe it to be too costly and to yield too little benefit, and we believe that it would be unjust to make demands on the healthcare system for those kinds of interventions, in particular, if it means that we have less of an ability to provide more basic healthcare services for all the folks who are currently uninsured or underinsured in our society. Let me give you just one more example, and I call it quits, and then we take questions, to just illustrate what that last point is about. This is the sort of question we would be asking one another. There is a device that can be implanted in patients It's called an implantable cardiac defibrillator. This is for patients who are at risk of having an arrhythmia that could prove a cardiac arrhythmia that could prove fatal. There are approximately 400,000 individuals in the United States who experience a fatal arrhythmia. This device is a device that shocks the heart back into a normal rhythm. And the cost of that device is $40,000. We implanted about 200,000 of those devices last year in the U.S. That's $8 billion worth. What's the problem there? The problem is this, that 81% of those devices will never fire over a five-year period of time. At 5 years, a battery in them has to be replaced at a cost of about $20,000. And so you say, wow, that looks like a huge waste of money because it's a security blanket of sorts. Can't we do better than that? Yes, we can. Because one of the things that was discovered about 3 or 4 years ago was something called the T-wave alternance test, which can be used to identify patients who are very unlikely over a two-year period of time to suffer an arrhythmic event that could potentially be fatal. The T-wave alternance test can tell us with 98.7% accuracy who those individuals are who are unlikely to have a fatal arrhythmia. The question for you guys is this. Would you endorse for your future possible older selves with finicky little hearts that send off weird little electronic signals every now and then, would you endorse a rationing protocol that would say that if I pass the T-wave alternance test, then I won't be entitled at public expense to one of these implantable cardiac defibrillators because it's 98.7% unlikely that I'm going to need it. Now, there's a 98.7% accuracy. That's really good. That's A+. But it's 1.3% of the time it's wrong. And what 1.3% of the time, and I should say, if we were to implement such a rationing protocol, we would reduce from 200, we'd reduce by 70,000 the number of individuals in whom we would currently implant one of those devices. That would save about $3 billion. Not a small chunk of change. But the cost of doing that is an error of 1.3%, which represents 800 people who, without that device, will in fact have a fatal arrhythmia. So you ask yourselves, would I endorse for my father, mother, grandfather, grandmother, or my future possible self a rationing protocol that would deny individuals one of these devices if they passed the T-wave alternance test? In order to, would I do that? Would I endorse that? In order to make sure that there is, that we have a reformed healthcare system that covers everyone with an affordable, comprehensive package of health benefits. That's the just caring problem. Let me stop there and give you a chance to ask questions and comment and whatever. Yes?
I have a comment. Perfect example of why healthcare costs are going up is in Pocahontas. The Dental Delta building is being expanded for the 450th time. Down the street, there's another dental plan administrator in a new building. I can't afford a new building. The library can't afford a new building. But our dental health care plan can.
I don't know the details of how that works or why it works that way or why they seem to be profitable enough to build these new buildings. Presumably, people are buying dental insurance and using it and generating the sort of profit that those companies need in order to build those new buildings. If you want to understand part of what makes the just caring problem very difficult as both a moral problem and a political problem, there are what Uwe Reinhardt, who's a Princeton economist, calls two great equations. One of those equations says cost control equals care control. And so the example I gave you with the implantable cardiac defibrillator illustrates that point. You want to control costs, you're going to control care, the amount of care that individuals get. You're going to deny individuals care that they need, in some sense of the word need, not just want, it's not a tummy tuck, but the care that they need is only will yield only very marginal benefit at too great a cost. The other great equation is cost control equals income control. There is no dollar on the cost side of the healthcare equation that is not a dollar that belongs to somebody on the income side of the equation. And so when we talk about healthcare cost containment, what we're really talking about is income containment for that dental group or for cancer researchers, for drug companies, for hospitals, for whoever. But that, when you look at who resists the kind of health reform that it looks like we need, especially if we use the words cost containment, then it's those groups, those institutions that have the greatest financial stake in the healthcare system as it is now. Yep.
Discuss a little more with us, if you would, the single payer plans in Europe and in Canada, and how come we have to reinvent the wheel here?
The question you're asking is really what I'll call a kind of political question. We made a really serious mistake in World War II, which we didn't realize was a mistake. It looked like a good idea. We had wage and price controls in World War II. I was born in World War II. It was still going on, but I don't remember it. But because we had wage and price controls in place, employers who wanted to reward good employees and hold on to them, they were permitted by the federal government to offer them benefits. And health insurance was a cheap benefit which could be provided. And that's what generated our employer-based form of health insurance that we have today. The problem, the practical, economic, political problem is, if we tried to make a jump from where we are today to a single-payer system as they have in Canada, we would somehow or other have to capture the equivalent of about $1.3 trillion that's now in the private sector as health insurance that's paid by employers on behalf of their employees. We have to capture that as a tax and transfer that money to the federal government. And there may be many employers who would jump at the thought of being able to do that. That would make their lives a lot easier. But it would, from the point of view of political conservatives, it would be something that would increase dramatically the size of the federal government, the total budget of the federal government. It would increase the federal budget by approximately 30% or so. And that's seen as a politically impossible task right now. All the Democrats want to do, or at least the liberal Democrats want to do, is they want to create something called a public option that would help to keep private health insurers honest. And that, which is a very modest kind of way of sort of controlling health costs and avoiding some of the most egregious kinds of injustices in our healthcare system, that is a real sticking point for this whole health reform debate. There are at least more conservative Democrats who are not, at least so far it seems, they're not willing to buy the idea of a public option. And a public option, of course, a public option, at least as it's now proposed, would only be available to the uninsured. It would not be an option for anybody whose employer currently provides health insurance, and employers would be mandated to provide health insurance or to pay a penalty, a serious penalty of some kind. So basically, for political reasons, it's not a good idea. I mean, to keep things as they are. And it is hugely wasteful. On one of the slides there I had, in the United States, we have administrative costs because of all these insurance plans and because of all the employers who all negotiate these different contracts with different insurers with different ranges of benefits and coverage and deductibles and co-payments and so on, which require an army of secretaries, clerks, accountants, and lawyers to sort out. We have administrative costs in our system of 16 to 22%. whereas in Europe and Canada, their pure administrative costs are in the range of 6 to 10%. So if the difference is only 10 percentage points of $2.5 trillion, that means we have $250 billion of money that is paying for healthcare administration that yields no care. And that amount of money, and this is the argument of the single-payer advocates, that amount of money would cover the 47 million without health insurance. And that's true. There's no question about it. But I don't think we're going to get there.
Are we going to get there? Step by very small step at a time.
I don't have a crystal ball.
I
can't answer that. But what I can say, I mean, there are some other models out there that are good enough and close enough that if as it seems now, we have to build on the system that's sort of in place. If we adopted something like the German model, which really requires that the insurers are really nonprofit entities, if we did that, then you could have 200, 300 plans out there. Administrative costs would be reasonable. And you wouldn't technically have a single-payer system, but you would have, from a moral point of view, something close enough to that, that you would have gotten rid of the worst injustices in our system as it is now. Up front. Yeah.
Okay. My question is, how do you value life? Where do you draw the line at?
Do you own a car?
Yes.
Do you drive a car?
Yes.
Do you ever think about what value you put on your own life when you drive that car? Is it worth it to take the risks of being on the street, on the highway? So your life's not priceless then. No. You trade the comfort and convenience of a car. Okay. Well, even though on one of my slides I pointed out, we vocalize this claim that we believe that human life is priceless, we being the U.S. society as a whole. We like to say that. We don't really mean it, not in practice, but we say it. But in reality, we make choices all the time that show that we don't really believe that our lives, our own lives, are priceless. If, for example, I said, you want a cheap and easy way to save 25,000 lives per year? Reduce the national speed limit to 30 miles an hour on your superhighways in every place. Can't go more than 30. All you have to do is change the highway signs. That's cheap and easy to do. Would I get elected to any office if that was my proposal? No. And so what we're saying is we want to drive like the Germans on the Autobahn. Really, that's what we want. But we'll compromise and settle for 80 or 80. No, not 70. Nobody. It's 80 or 85 is what we'll go for. And we believe that police are unjust if they give us a ticket at that level. Wait, if I answered your question at all, try it again.
But there is a value of someone's life, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But where do you begin to draw the line for one? Like, you gave some examples, like Mr. Diaz, who mm-hmm. in advance,
yep.
Alzheimer's, gets pneumonia. But what about someone that's at the beginning of
stage
development?
Maybe
retain some quality of life.
There, I would ask you, what would you imagine would be a moral argument that would justify our denying those individuals costly life-prolonging care, which they would want, presumably? And at least I can't think of a really good argument that would justify that, because there are even individuals who have what is termed moderate Alzheimer's, who are pleasantly senile, is the language that's sometimes used. They're still capable of appreciating a life. They don't appreciate it quite the way you and I do, but they do appreciate it. But in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's, and to make sure everybody understands what that phrase means, that means I don't know who I am anymore. I can't connect up memories of what my life has been. I don't have a future that I plan. I don't know who any of you are. I don't know who any of my relatives are. I don't recognize anybody. I don't know where I am. I have paranoid fantasies. I'll yell and scream. I'll go into psychotic states. Or I may be just totally silent. I don't have use of language for the most part. I don't understand anything you say to me. That's advanced Alzheimer's. And it's horrible. But there's nothing, we have nothing in the medical armamentarium right now that suggests we can reverse or control or do anything about that. But again, we talk to one another and we ask ourselves, what am I willing to spend from my money by way of sustaining my life if it were like that? Would I want to bankrupt or deny my grandchildren a college education so that I could have 2 years of life in that advanced state of Alzheimer's? I can't think of a good reason for wanting to do something like that. You know? Go ahead.
Do we have any examples in the United States of what you call rational democratic decisions along this line? What's happening in Oregon? What are your observations?
Oh, okay, good question. Oregon went through this process of priority setting. And the governor of, well, first, the person who was president of the Oregon Senate at when this whole process started was a physician who then became governor. And his name was John Kitzhaber. Kitzhaber said that he was disgusted as a physician with the arbitrariness associated with the rationing as it affected the poor and uninsured in the state of Oregon. And he wanted to have something like complete health insurance for everybody in the state, but he couldn't build enough political support for that. But he could build political support for the idea that everyone below the poverty level was going to be covered by the Medicaid program. But in order to do that and to make it affordable, he went through this sort of public process of talking about what kinds of priorities there ought to be in terms of covered healthcare services. And they came up with a list of like 740 different, what they called condition treatment pairs. And they had insurers figure out what would be the cost for their population, their Medicaid population, of meeting those different needs. And there was a commission that was responsible for this. And the understanding with the state legislature was you may not touch the way in which these priorities have been set. All you can do as a legislative body is figure out how much money you want to allocate to the Medicaid program and to covering everybody who's poor in the state of Oregon. And so the first time the state legislature said, well, we'll put up, I don't know, X number of hundreds of millions of dollars or maybe $2 billion, something like that. And so the governor said, well, that takes you down to 343 on the list. Do you want me to call in a few reporters and let the reporters tell the public what's below 343? And so the members of the state legislature said, nope, we'll find the money. So they went down to something like about, maybe it was 572 or somewhere in that vicinity, and said, that's where we'll draw the line. And so below that line, for example, just so you know what was below it, would be 600 gram premature infants. These would be infants who were born at 23, 24 weeks and who weighed only slightly more than a pound. They would have been smaller than the size of my fist. And he said, in effect, one of the judgments they made was those infants have such a poor prognosis. A small percentage of them would survive and would survive with minimal impairments, but most of them will die in the NICU after incurring quite a few costs and quite a bit of misery. And so that was one sort of thing that, in effect, he said, We won't pay for that. We won't do that in order to provide what we know to be cost-effective care for the poor that does a lot more good, for sure. That was the kind of process that was engaged in. That process was public. Nothing was hidden. It did not engage as many people as would be desirable, as I would find desirable. I really think I want to have a kind of public conversation about these issues, that which really is at least available in some sense to any American who wants to be part of that conversation. That's what I think has to happen. The public has to be educated about these issues in order to appreciate what these limits are that we somehow have to deal with in a fair way, in a way that's respectful of our sense of compassion in our society as well as justice.
What's that, man?
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, okay. Wait, I was going to.
In your slides, you spoke about a 97-year-old doctor who had the the heart thing. You also spoke about an infant with a bowel problem.
Mm-hmm.
The young lady in West Virginia that was 19 and passed away due to lack of medication. Take those patients, if you would, and explain how they would have been treated through the single-payer system in Canada and or the European system, if you could.
Ooh, that, I don't know if I can give a confident answer to that question. I'm going to have to give you, probably going to have to give you a vague and less than satisfactory answer. One of the advantages that Canada and Europe have, because they have lower administrative costs, is they have more wiggle room. They have in place various kinds of restrictions and understandings about the use of some higher cost technologies. So they rely a lot on research that's been done and under what we would call cost effectiveness evidence-based practice guidelines. We are, just to give you an example, we are extremely profligate in our use of MRI scanners and CT scanners and this other PET scanners. It's very expensive diagnostic equipment. That represents the use of that technology has grown by, 800% over 20 years. We now spend, I think it's about $220 billion a year on that technology. Most health researchers say that it's overused. Why is it overused? Well, because, going back to my story about McLaren Hospital, if Sparrow, if Sparrow Hospital buys an MRI scanner, and Lansing would be well served by one MRI scanner, Ingham is going to buy an MRI scanner. And each of those things is going to cost $3 million. In order to have a payback, in order to cover the cost of running them and the initial investment and so on, each of those hospitals will, in a sense, be happy that their physicians use those services for what are very, very marginal kinds of reasons, where they could, with their other cheap diagnostic mechanisms, get the same outcome without a cost of $2,000, $3,000 for one of those scans. But if the machine is there and if the insurance is going to pay for it, then it gets used. If you build it, they will come. That's the way it is with MRI scanners, with proton beam accelerators, with you name whatever the costly new health technology is. Europe and Canada don't do that. The other thing they don't do is, if you look at, remember what I said about who spends the money? It's physicians. Who are the physicians who spend the most dollars? Medical specialists. So in the U.S., 2/3 of our physicians are medical specialists rather than primary care physicians. In Europe, 2/3, and Canada, 2/3 of their physicians are primary care physicians, and they restrict the number of individuals who can go into those different medical specialties. Now, what that means in practice is that it's only individuals who have really serious cardiac problems who see a cardiologist or a cardiothoracic surgeon. Individuals whose heart problems can be managed effectively and efficiently, for the most part, 99% of the time, will be managed by a primary care physician at a much lower cost with much less in the way of technology intensity. And so, going back to your question, I don't know if they would overtly deny Dr. DeBakey surgery for his aortic aneurysm, but my guess is his physician, his surgeon, would persuade him, you know, you've lived a good life. You can get by for at least another year. Enjoy it. Don't take the chances that you were disinclined to take anyway. Don't listen to your family. Don't be persuaded. You would be surprised if you were to read the medical journals, as I had to do when doing the research for the book, with the help of my partner Gene back there, with the red hair. If you had read those medical journals, one of the things that leapt out at me was all these articles about these very difficult, tricky, complicated kinds of surgery that were being done on 90-year-olds up to age 100. And the physicians who did this said, well, you know, when I was in training, this was just unthinkable. But, you know, I don't know, these guys want to do it, and I think I can do it competently, and I'm not going to tell them no. So we do it, and it's paid for. You know, Medicare will pay for it. Medicare doesn't say you can't do it. So that's...
Somewhat.
Okay.
Can I ask one other thing?
Sure.
Do you think, as the healthcare debate goes about the nation, will morality change any... I don't know how to phrase that. Assisted suicide, do you think that will come up in any of the debates? Or will the nation's view on that change as we go through healthcare debates?
That may become a kind of what I'll call option. There has been some change already. You may or may not be aware of the fact that physician-assisted suicide has been legalized in the state of Washington and in the state of Oregon, and it's likely to be legalized in Montana. We are likely to see those kinds of changes, but I don't know if those changes are necessarily motivated by cost issues. They're motivated by the fact that some individuals are faced with really awful, prolonged process of dying that even with advanced palliative care as we have it now is unlikely to be successful in addressing those issues.
One thing about, we have this discussion about the Oregon plan.
Uh-huh.
It's easy for me to say what I don't want them to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so easy for me to say, I mean, that kind of discussion is not the kind of discussion you're talking about.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Well, the central point behind what I propose is that we make decisions for ourselves, but we have to do it collectively. I mean, that's the whole, because we can't avoid having an insurance mechanism of some kind. And so that's why we have to operate under the same rules. It's a capitalistic society, it's a free society. So I always say, if you've got a platinum MasterCard or whatever that would allow you to buy $1 million worth of health care that will extend your life by a month, you have a right to that. As long as your purchase of that is not subsidized by taxes, and as long as you don't deny somebody else access to life-prolonging health care that they need and have a stronger just claim to. So as long as we're not short of ICU beds, as long as we're not short of artificial hearts, you know, we can produce as many of them as you want. We can do that. If we're ready to call it quits, I'll thank you all for your time and attention. If anybody wants to buy one of these books and have me sign it, you are welcome to do that. $30 rather than $50. That's what I pay for them when I get them from Oxford University Press. You're not under any obligation. That's just an offer. Thank you.
I don't know how you know about these events. How many people have found out about